Faster than the speed of sound, across the top of the world and the bottom, from any place to anywhere, our airmen fly. They roam a sky now free of shot and shell. Yes, fortune is good indeed, and yet... Who thinks that fortune cannot change her mind prepares a dreadful jest for all mankind. And who stands safest? Tell me, is it he that spreads and swells in puffed prosperity, or blessed with little, whose preventing care in peace provides fit arms against a war?
Today is the 41st anniversary of our Air Force. To say happy birthday, the Armed Forces Radio Service presents a special program called Peace is the Lady with Wings, starring Ken Harvey. To the Air Force, then, whose thundering motors rend the air. To the Air Force, whose jets and rockets are a muffled shriek. To the Air Force, that plays a strange lullaby with words that say, you may sleep quietly tonight without fear, knowing that peace is the lady with wings.
Behind these heavily guarded doors, a secret session is about to take place in building 125 at Wright Field. The men are officer engineers. Some are visionaries who look to the unknown realms of the future. Others are practical men who say, you've got to show me. But one thing they have in common. They're experts, all. And now their commanding officer, a lieutenant general of the Air Force, comes in.
As you were, General. It's less than a week now since the war in Europe ended. There isn't a man in this room who doesn't pray this is the last war for all time. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's the one thing none of us can tell. Because of that, I've called you together. I want you to let your hair down. Gentlemen, I want your prophetic opinions on what the next war will be like.
Are you really serious, sir?
Yes, I'm afraid I am. Dead serious.
And so, behind these locked doors, the men are really letting their hair down. And they're talking. The talk, believe me, is something out of this world. Guided missiles that could make any spot on Earth a target minutes away from any other spot. Machines capable of 4,000 miles an hour. Weird-shaped aircraft like nothing ever seen before. Power plants the size of your fist that could hurl giant bombers through the air. And things a bit saner, too. Such as 50-ton bombs and pilotless aircraft and radar. And they stop only when another general says...
gentlemen, perhaps we'd better stop this before we scare ourselves to death.
In this year of peace, is this talk of war? Oh, no, not at all. Let's get that straight. This is talk about how to prevent war. Those men were delving and probing into cold, hard scientific facts, for they knew that such a future conflict could be so terrible as to obliterate all people from the face of the earth. That was an ounce of prevention talk. It was serious business, so important that a special plane flew the written results of that meeting to Washington, so that other men with ideas could see them and act upon them. With its eyes on the sky, the Air Force also had its feet on the ground. And in that one point lies an almost unbelievable success story. A success story of how we cleared the skies over Europe and then the Pacific. For the Air Force lives by the twin creeds of an ounce of prevention and preparedness. This amazing story begins with yet another closed session. Place, one of the great aircraft plants. Time, the winter of 1938.
There it is. See for yourself how vitally important these changes are.
Yes, General, I can. These P-17s are already in production. What do you want us to do?
Oh, I know we're insistent, but at the same time, common sense tells me that these modifications aren't practical when applied to the P-17.
Well, then what do you suggest we do?
I can tell you what we need. We need a long-range, high-altitude, high-speed bomber with a much greater bomb capacity than the P-17.
That's a lot of need. But we'll see what we can do.
Hey,
action was taken. Not until the war in Europe had been on for several months. Then the War Department circular went out, setting up specifications for a four-engine bomber design. And now again, back to the aircraft plant.
You've seen it on the drafting boards. Now here's the factory model. Weighs about 73,000 pounds gross.
The Wright Field engineers look it over carefully, very carefully. They shake their heads. Then the chief says,
"You didn't go far enough."
What? We didn't do what?
You didn't go far enough.
And while the Stukas came diving and screaming down out of the skies of Europe, and the Messerschmitts and the Fokker Wolfs and Heinkels were having their day in the sun, our Air Force, as always, had its eyes on the days ahead. And so they said,
"This isn't our war yet, but maybe we'd better send some military experts, engineers, and test pilots to England and France just for a first-hand look at what's going on."
So they went. They saw, they came back, and told their story.
They've got cannon-packing fighters, heavy armor protection, and flame-proof fuel tanks. That's what they've got, and what we haven't got.
All right, then what kind of a plane is it you want us to build?
What we want is a bomber that will have an unusually long operating radius with a full bomb load that can carry at least 5 tons of bombs at better than 300 miles an hour and can get up into the substratosphere between 30,000 and 40,000 feet. In short, we want a bomber that can pack more machine guns and cannon than any bomber ever built or likely to be built during the war.
Hey, that's a big job, General. Why don't you agree?
Sure, I agree. A big job for a big plane. It has to be. You don't want to send a boy to do a man's job.
But all during this time, and even before, the carping critics were having their say.
We're way behind the times. What do they mean by relying on air power in this day and age?
What can you expect from these bomber generals? You mark my words. They're building the wrong kind of air force.
Nevertheless, long before Pearl Harbor, the Air Force was building and planning to get into production. Said a spokesman,
"We can't afford to think in terms of rockets and spaceships that will travel 300 miles an hour and knife down in a frightened London. We can't rely on fighter planes powered with rocket engines that can go 30 miles up but can fight for only 5 minutes. We've got to build an airplane that'll take us first to the battlefield and then fight. And the battlefield might be 4,000 miles eastward and almost 3 times that distance to the west. There may be thousands of miles between the United States and our enemies, because even today, in 1939, it looks as though someday the war may be fought with the United States in the thick of it."
The Air Force, with eager eyes on the super bomber, was looking in the right direction. The aircraft plant also looked, first to its model 341, and then said,
"Okay, we've enlarged upon it and improved it. Here, what do you think now?"
Said the Air Force.
"Looks good."
"Yeah, it looks good.
We're accepting it and we'll call it the XB-29, the first of the super fortresses." "Yeah? We'll sign a contract. Go ahead and build 3 full-size X jobs. 2 for flight tests and 1 for structural testing."
That was August 1940. The growing pains were terrific. As with all new airplane designs, first a series of models were built for wind tunnel testing. Cost $6,000 to $60,000 apiece. Doing the testing, 2 far western universities and the big laboratories at Langley Field. The tests were encouraging. Air flows over the wings, fuselage and tail surfaces of the small model, swishing around the thin airfoil section of its wing design. Air swirls over the highly streamlined engine nacelles. Engineers squint into the test chambers of the wind tunnel.
Make a note of that. We'll have to correct it.
How about the shape of the rudder?
You know, we've already changed it several times. We'll have to do it again. I tell you, I think we'll wind up with a dorsal fin and a B-17-shaped design.
Turret?
Yeah, we'll have to do something never thought of before, an armament installation. We'll hold the turret almost flush with the fuselage to get more speed.
Scales, recording devices, gauges, they all said it looked pretty good. And then one day, a phone call came into the offices at Wright Field.
Sergeant Carter speaking.
The general's there?
Oh, just a moment, sir. It's for you, sir. The colonel's calling.
Hello, Don. What's on your mind?
General, I'm at the plant. The models in the wind tunnels look like the greatest plane ever built.
Well, good. Splendid. You might as well place the first production order for the B-29.
But the first model hasn't even been flown yet.
I know. We just have to put our faith and trust in the company that's building them. Go ahead. Time's beginning to run out.
Then, to see and feel what the new bomber would be like, the Wright Field experts took a look at a full-scale model made of wood and metal. As a whole, it looked good. It was okayed. Still, some changes were made. More than 1,000 changes before the first production job was finished. Now was the time when the headaches really began.
We've got to design special tools and jigs. And the materials we need are hard to get. How do we do it?
Spread it out. Spread it out all over the country, but get it. We want this thing finished in a hurry.
The production program dwarfed anything previously attempted by the aviation industry. And it was spread out.
Seattle and Renton, Washington.
Wichita, Kansas. Marietta, Georgia. Detroit and Chicago.
Things began to roll. This huge new plane was more than skin and bolts and power. More than just another big experimental bomber. This was the B-29. This was the Air Force's Sunday punch. It had to have speed and range and bomb capacity. It had to be good enough to strike anywhere in the world at the snap of a command. And so brain and brawn and sweat and skill went into it.
How can we make these parts first? The others are still on the drafting table.
Don't ask me. All I know is they said make them.
Are you the one who designed this section?
Yeah.
Well, I'm engineering the section next year. Let's get in a huddle and see what we can come up with.
Say, Al tells me the holes for the control cables would be left out of the bulkhead. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
How come?
Because we don't know yet just where the holes are to be placed.
That? Well, you see, they were testing the pressurizing of a cabin when the nose blew out and tore out the whole front end of the building. But that occurred only because it had been pumped up to 10 times the maximum pressure for which it had been designed. With few standards to serve as guides, many things had to be figured out on the spot. For example,
the rudder is so high it comes within 2 feet of touching the ceiling rafters. It won't pass under the trusses of the building. And the 141-foot wing won't go through the factory doors. What now?
We'll put up a special 2-story building around the plane where we can conduct the tests.
Hmm? Well, Hornet won't go to the mountain, and the mountain will go to Hornet.
Yes, that was it. Or was it vice versa? Anyway, it was done. Shaped like a huge T, the building housed the plane, hydraulic jacks, cranes, bags filled with BBs, thousands of them, and recording scales, gauges, and dials. Inside, the engineers tried to wreck this $3 million beauty. They twisted her all-clad skin until the wrinkles cracked and burst open. They exerted pressure on her wings until they nearly folded. They gave her the works, then said,
"Well, I think she's ready."
And yet, even before it took to the sky, before it had even reached the halfway stage of jigs and framework, the Air Force gave the go-ahead sign for mass production. Plants were built to turn out the big boy on assembly line. This time, Wright Field wasn't kidding. The people of Seattle on September 21, 1942, were going about their business as usual. But in the sky, something new had been added.
Hey, Mac, take a look at that, will you? Wow!
Look at the size of that baby.
Yeah, somebody's in for an awful lot of trouble.
At the control sits the test pilot, one of the best in the business. He brings her in, sets her down like the honey she is, then an Air Force colonel says to him,
"Well, Eddie, what do you think?"
"Colonel, she's a sweet airplane. Flies better than the B-17.
I think it's one of the cleanest designs ever built."
"Coming from you, Eddie, that's the best compliment any plane could get."
Well, the record of the B-29 is now history. A history written in the Pacific by wave after wave of saturation bombing. And speaking of compliments, here's another one. After the war, a high-ranking Japanese air officer was talking to an American interrogator.
"You Americans win war because of terrible B-29s. Very big airplane. How you possibly manufacture them so quickly?"
Well, there are a lot of answers to that, but probably the best one was given by a Hoosier-born seaman, first class. Aboard one of our naval vessels on patrol in the Pacific, when the B-29s first went into action, his ship was rolling along in peaceful waters, when suddenly it was alerted.
Planes approaching, planes approaching, battle stations, man your battle stations.
Boy, look at them. They're really coming in.
Yeah, times like this, I wish I was a midget so this gun parapet would cover me all over.
Hey, Indiana, put that helmet back on. What are you doing lighting a cigarette? You nuts or something? Here comes the lieutenant.
Put that cigarette out. What's the matter with you? They might be enemy planes.
Heck no. I mean, no, sir. They're our babies. Nobody can build anything that big and make it fly but us.
The Air Force leaves very little to chance. A plane is born and tested and armed, but that's only the beginning. It has to be pre-tested, tried out under combat conditions to see what it can do against an enemy. In short, the Air Force demands and gets proof positive. And that's where the amazing and fabulous proving grounds of Eglin Field, Florida comes in. Softly, like silk in the breeze, that's our B-29 on a bright, sunny afternoon in 1943. Down below, the rugged Florida scrubland stretches out and out. And all of a sudden, you gasp and catch your breath. You know it's Florida, yet you're looking at a city that belongs on the other side of the world. Narrow, winding streets and alleys, wide boulevards, and it's an exact replica, like a scene from a movie travelogue. The Air Force has a date with the real thing on a day not far off. And so, day and night, night and day, real bombers with bellies full of bombs blast away. At ground level, or 30,000 feet up, the bombs crash into the frail houses. But some of the bombs don't explode. The houses are too light to set off the detonator caps. So, we try something else. These are firebombs, hissing and flaming down out of the sky. And these work. Now half the city is ablaze. And we turn back to Eglin Field to make our report. The Air Force doesn't make blind dates. The airmen like to know just what the lady will look like. Early 1944, at a B-29 base in China.
Any idea, sir, when we'll get the gasoline?
No, I wish I did know. We've got to sweat out this rainy season until we get enough gasoline to fly. But while we're sweating it out, I think I'll send a message.
Back at Eglin Field, a secret teletype message is coming in. The commanding general of the field reads it.
Bomb Puerto Rico.
Now out on the field, a big B-29 is on the ready line. The bomb bay is full of dummy bombs. The gasoline tank's full. The crew is being briefed.
Find out how far it can fly. What's the most efficient altitude? Keep an eye on the engines and find out how well the new air position indicator will work. Okay, that's all.
The big boy thunders down the runway. Slowly it lifts, slowly. Now it's airborne. A few vacationers in Miami look up, see it fly by, and wonder about its size. The plane heads out to sea. The pilot to the co-pilot.
Weather's kind of rough.
Yeah, gonna have our hands full.
The navigator is in a sweat.
This long stretch of water without a landmark. Trying to hit an island on the nose. Not gonna be easy.
In the big side blisters, the gunners talk.
How you doing?
I'm getting numb from sitting so long.
From the tail gunner in his little cubbyhole, a simple statement.
I think I'm going nuts.
The big plane roars on. Hours later, it comes down out of a cloud bank.
There it is down there. Puerto Rico. Give Skip an A for navigation.
The plane circles a few minutes, long enough for the bombardier to set his sights, long enough to make a trial run over the island. The bomb bay doors are coming open, and then...
Bombs away!
The dummy bombs spin down into the ocean. The islanders don't even see them. The big Super 4 turns and points its nose back to Eglin. 3/4 of the way back home, and she's still purring mighty sweet when... One of the engines is acting up. Another sputter and almost quits. The pilot has to give exact throttle control to keep the plane at cruising speed. But he does it, and without further incident, they're back at the Florida base. A secret conference, every phase of the flight carefully written up in report form. The report is condensed, and a long teletype clacks its way around the world to the general and his B-29 crew waiting in China. The general reads it. It says, in part,
VH Island mission success, full load, 3,200 miles, engines.
What it means is this. A very heavy bomber had flown a mission for 3,200 miles nonstop with its full load of bombs, and that there had been trouble with the engines. The message tells other things, too. And that night in his tent, the general says to his master sergeant,
Jim, do you think those engines will hold out?
Yes, sir, I think they will. If Eglin Field says so, they'll do it.
Several days later, a whole flight of superforts takes off from its base in China. And the next day, we read the glaring headlines. B-29s in big raid. The superforts had flown from Chengdu, China, to hit their objective. Incidentally, the distance over water was 1,600 miles out and 1,600 miles back. The same distance as that from Eglin Field to Puerto Rico. Pre-testing. Proof. Positive. As we said, the Air Force doesn't like to keep a blind date. It was late in the European war, and suddenly a new and diabolical weapon came roaring down out of the skies over to London to shock the people with fear. The V-1s, winged rocket bombs, pilotless, mechanically controlled, rocket-powered. They crashed into the streets, they screamed into the night, they hit anywhere, churches, homes, hospitals, pubs. They came, then they stopped, but they came again. Top Allied officials went into a huddle.
Of course, we've been rather expecting this sort of thing, you know.
Yes, the reports of our agents on the French coast have been telling us about this new weapon.
According to them, the whole coast is bristling with platforms for launching this flying bomb. Well, if the enemy is allowed to carry out his new blitz, they can destroy London. Or rather, what's left of it.
Yes, this could decide the war in their favor, all right. I don't know exactly what, but we've got to do something about it. Get to the Air Force headquarters in the Pentagon at Washington.
Across the channel, over the ocean, comes the urgent plea, for God's sake, do something. But what? How could you fight a robot that you can't even catch, when you don't even know where it's going to be or what it's going to do? You might as well try to shoot down a bomber that can fly faster than your best fighter planes. Yes, they had something this time, all right. Something terrible, mysterious, something fanatical. This was the V-1, but we already knew the V-2 was coming, bigger and more deadly, faster than sound. A 2,000-pound rocket that arches up more than 70 miles into the air above the earth, then comes knifing down in a white-hot streak, and the only time you hear it, it's too late, after it has exploded. So the Air Force in Washington said,
here's one we can't figure out. Better get in touch with Eglin Field and see what kind of a defense we can get against that V-bomb.
That's what we're up against.
Now, what can you do about it down here at Eglin?
All this isn't news to us. We've read the reports, too. And months before the first V-bombs hit London, we were already figuring out a way to stop them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's encouraging.
We took a simple approach. Start at the beginning. If we couldn't get the bomb in the air, then get it before it was launched on the ground. Better still, knock out the launching platforms.
Yeah, the theory sounds fine, but how did it work out?
Come along with me. I'll show you how we went at it.
Now, out on the 450,000-acre reservation.
Well, here they are.
But these are exact replicas of the robot launching platforms.
Right. Reinforced concrete 3 feet thick. Wherever we place these platforms, we set up a defense of anti-aircraft fire like the kind along the French coast. It made it so tough for our bombers to get through and destroy the bomb ramps.
Good going, Colonel. I'll have to admit I'm much impressed.
When the replicas were completed, we threw the book at them. More than 400 attacks. B-17s let them have their biggest bombs from 30,000 feet. B-25s and 26s, A-20s with medium bombs, all kinds. Slammed home their explosives at lower altitudes.
Any fighters?
Yes, P-47s, 38s, and 21s followed through from every altitude. But after each attack, the anti-aircraft batteries reported that their radar guns had shot down, in simulated fashion, most of the planes. And the roll bomb ramps were still standing.
That's about the whole book. Nothing else to try, I suppose.
There was one more thing. One day, we hit on the idea of firebombs. So we sent fast fighters in to drop them on the concrete bases.
They either melted the structures or cracked and burned them. That was the answer. And even if the firebombs didn't destroy the ramps, they made it so hot inside that the operators had to get out.
The anti-aircraft, they still had to contend with that.
That wasn't too hard a problem. We did it with on-the-deck flying. Fast fighters came in at fence level, hedge-hopping at 400 miles an hour, and slammed the bombs home with arrow-like precision.
Well, this looks like it's it for my money. What do I tell Washington?
You can tell Washington that we've got the answer.
In the Pentagon at Washington, a phone is picked up and four words are spoken.
We've got the answer.
And across the sea, fighter squadrons are alerted by these four words. They go over at low altitude and terrific speed, with firebombs slung under their bellies and wings. And they come back with the wire from the fences of France hanging on their wings. The report, the roll bomb platforms no longer exist. Yes, the Air Force had the answer. Well, that's the way things are with the Air Force. Lots of hustle and know-how. Or, as they say in some parts of the country, lots of get up and get. The Air Force is the kind of outfit that can do two things at the same time. Keep one eye on the sky and the other on the future. The only thing about the Air Force that never changes is change itself. By the time one new plane is in the air, they've got another one on the drawing boards that's better. Why, they tell us that the B-29 is now called a medium bomber. Things might get tough again, who knows? But if they do, it's good to know that our airmen will get their firstest with the mostest. And when they do, they'll be carrying the difference.
Happy birthday, Air Force, and many happy returns of the day. We like your lullaby. We like the words that say, you may sleep quietly tonight without fear, knowing that peace is the lady with wings.
I've been listening to Peace is the Lady with Wings, with Ken Harvey as narrator. The script was written by David B. Eskind, produced and directed by Will Scott. Those in the cast with Ken Harvey were Paul McVeigh, Bud Whittem, Jerry Sheldon, Ramsey Hill, Jack Crucian, Bob Young, Lloyd Jenkins, Ben Wright, Kirk Reagan, Dawes Butler, Don Messick, Jack Carroll, Raymond Rowe, and Rye Billsbury. The music was composed by Earl Lawrence with the orchestra under the direction of Michel Perrier. Speaking, this is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.